the political side of it, and then there's the real story.
There's a lot to unpack right there. It wasn't quite the interview I thought that was going to be.
There's a reason for it.
This will be officially my favorite podcast I've ever done.
So I'm curious about when you started First Majestic in 2001. Like, how did you, some of the people in our audience are entrepreneurs or they're just getting started. How did you decide, hey, I'm going to start a silver mine, I'm going to start a metals company, and, you know, how did you get to there when you started in 2001?
Yeah, no, because I came from a copper company, right? So, you know, I was on the floor of the Vancouver Stock Exchange from 84 to 89. So I worked for three of the largest national banks in Canada as a pro trader. So, and then when everything went electronic and all the floor traders got laid off in 1989, I found myself out of a job. And I started working for, I worked for Murray Pesum, actually. I'm not sure if you know that name, but went to work for him for a couple of years, about a year or so, and learned the right and wrong things, what to do out there. And, I love math and I love finance and I just kind of fell into mining because, you know, Vancouver is, you know, such a mining centric city. And it just all kind of came together. And then I put First Quantum together in 92. And that was, you know, more or less just a series of people I built around me that kind of put that company together. It was I was quite young. I was in my early 30s and it worked out quite well, obviously. Then I kind of went into retirement in 2000, watched the NASDAQ bubble burst over the next couple of years and saw gold at 250 and silver at $5 and figured it was time to put together another company. And then, there's too many gold companies out there as far as I was concerned. There was not enough silver companies, and silver to me looked like copper. And I decided, because there was such a niche market, in my opinion, because there's no players really out there except for a small handful, I figured silver was the place to go. And that's why I put together a silver company.
What's the addressable market for silver? Like, when you think about, you know, as long as I can remember, I think I was a kid, I was probably 1980. I think it was the Hunt brothers or the Bass brothers. Someone tried to corner the silver market, got themselves blown up. I have a lot of my friends that accumulate silver like crazy. What's the addressable market there? Like, in your opinion, I mean, you've been in it for such a long time. What is the future of the silver market look like? And what's the addressable market for silver look like? Because I know you started a store, which I'm fascinated with too, which we'll get to in a second.
Yeah, you know, I love technology, and I guess, you know, being, you know, the founder of a copper company, I learned the importance of, you know, metals in technology. And in the early 2000s, when I was looking at silver, I realized how important it was in the whole scheme of things when it comes to, you know, what we do, whether it's computers or cell phones or automobiles or refrigerators or fridges or pretty well every single device that we need as the human race consumes silver. And I figured that was not going to change. The difference back then was there was no electric cars or solar panels. Now today, you know, we have two industries that are consuming 30% of the world's supply of silver, which didn't exist 10 years ago. So last year, the human race consumed 1.2 billion ounces of silver, and the miners produced 820 million ounces. And only about 100 and some odd 50 million, 125 to 150 million is recycled. So there's this huge deficit of somewhere between 200 and 300 million ounces last year. And that's been going on now for 6 years in a row. Consumption this year, 2024, is expected to be about 1.4 billion ounces. The miners aren't going to produce anymore. Miners are 820, call it. And recycling's not changing much because recycling doesn't pay. There's no money in it. So the deficits continue. So that has to affect price eventually.
So, I mean, obviously you're not going to comment on this, but if you looked at your current price of First Majestic and the price of silver, there's probably an apex part, right, where the price of silver gets to a point where First Majestic's printing money?
Well, we have in the past. It's, you know, of course we've got inflation and you know, those types of things, your employment costs increasing, and the peso has been quite weak, which has hurt us, unfortunately. Or, I mean, the peso has been quite strong, pardon me. So that's, but, you know, more, you know, we're cash flowing, we're positive, and that's not the issue. But, yeah, no, we, you know, when silver was $50, it was a lot of fun. We'll get back there. And, you know, we're one of the top three, you know, call it in the top. There's only three silver companies to buy in the world, or actually four, I guess. Hecla, Coeur, Pan American, ourselves. So those, you know, outside of those four, you know, who's there to buy? And then we all produce, funny enough, we all produce about the same amount of silver. We're all about 10 million ounces of silver. We are 25 million of silver equivalent, but that other amount is all gold. In the case of Hecla, their largest metal would be zinc. In the case of Pan American, their largest metal would be gold. And Coeur d'Alene, their largest metal would be, it's actually mix lead, zinc, and copper. They produce a bunch of stuff. But so we're 50 some odd percent silver. Hecla would be probably 25. Pan American would be probably 25. Coeur would be about 30. We're about 50, 55.
If you're at 50, 55 silver, what's the rest?
Gold.
Got it.
Just gold.
Got it. Wow. Okay. Well, when I met Jason, he told me you were his favorite CEO besides me, but I think he said that I was his favorite CEO, but he was on my payroll. So I realized, and he's been talking about interviewing you for like at least 5 years. I don't know why this was an act of God to get you on the show, but I'm glad you're here. But I think we've been trying to get you on the show for as long as I can remember. I think that was, we tried by Twitter, but Christy, our producer, somehow got you on the show. So I'm glad you're here. We're big fans.
Absolutely. Cause Keith can talk about it, but like La Encantada, which is in Mexico, that's one of the mines that I think are coming online. You know, I'll let Keith touch on that, but he's got several mines in Mexico that are producing a ton of silver. And Keith, I don't know why this is, and you can talk about this too, but in the Earth's crust, silver is harvested at about a ratio of 7 to 1, meaning 7 ounces of silver for every 1 ounce of gold. But when I do the math today, the silver to gold ratio is sitting around 85 or 86. What that means, Todd, is for every 80, it takes 85 or 86 ounces of silver to actually equal in fiat 1 ounce of gold. I mean, it's just a total disconnect.
Is it disconnected, Keith?
Oh, absolutely. We can get into it throughout the interview, but silver trades 1 billion ounces a day in the paper markets. So we call, you know, let's say there's 320 trading days in a year. So that's 320 billion ounces of silver trade in the paper markets per year. The miners produce 820 million a year. So yeah. The leverage, you know, do the math. That's like what, 400 to 1 or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
So, for us, you know, the leverage is crazy. So that's why we opened the mint, because for us to take our production off the market, and you do that math, for us to take 10 million ounces off the market, just for easy math, that's the equivalent of taking 3 billion ounces out of the paper market.
Yeah. So it's not like spot, like Bitcoin, right?
That's the difference between ETF and the new IBIT and the ETFs for Bitcoin. They have to have a treasury of 1-to-1 ratio. And then someone like SLV, which I'm not a fan of, it's not a recommendation, or PSLV, which I am a fan of, which we can talk about. Yeah, there's derivatives. There's massive paper, could be shorting in play, obviously. Like you said, it's 400-to-1. How can you trade all that paper? When there's not,
it doesn't make sense to me though, because if you have a demand that's greater than what you're mining, how's the demand being met? Keith, how's the demand being met if you have a demand that's greater than mining?
No, it's a big question. And, that's why I criticize the Silver Institute, because when we're not members, I canceled our membership of the Silver Institute a few years ago because I'm so displeased with the data that they publish, because, that's a very valid question. I would love to have answers myself. I remember when Putin was, in the gold vaults in Russia when he was holding, his gold bar. This is like, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago. And, pretty famous photograph of him inspecting the Russian gold hoards that they've been buying over the last several years. And so he's standing in the vault, and I zoom in on the photograph. And along the back wall, there's this whole line of pallets of silver bars. And I go, wow, there's a lot of silver there. So, and they don't report it. So, is that where the silver's coming from? I have no clue. We know China's not exporting silver. It's against the law in China to export silver. We know in India they're buying silver. Mm-hmm. They're big consumers. So it's a very valid question. And it's a very secretive industry, and we don't have an answer.
That's a weird idea, though. You saw race recently with Bitcoin. The miners are mining 900. They're buying 4,000.
40,000.
Oh, it went for parabolic, right?
Yeah, BlackRock's buying.
Right. So the price almost doubled, basically.
Yeah, but it took BlackRock like three or four months to buy more than what Michael Saylor's been accumulating for years.
It seems like maybe it was 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah, it might have been.
Very quickly.
But that's, Keith, how come like every hard asset and commodity, keeping this in mind, has moved up significantly from their all-time lows, yet silver here sits at $25 an ounce. Keith, do you think it's that the macroeconomic indicators and like you said, business, everything that has to do with silver in all of our products, goods and services, do you think it's kind of is suppressed because if it wasn't, the goods and services would go through the roof as far as cost goes?
Well, you ask the same questions I ask every day. So like if you're Sony or Tesla or BMW, doesn't really matter who, and you need to have 20 million ounces of silver for your product that you're producing in 2024. You're going to approach the big traders, which is pretty well JP Morgan or HSBC or whoever they are.
Yep.
And you're going to sign a contract for delivery of those ounces, and you're going to tell that bank to deliver those ounces to whatever port that they need to be delivered to. So as a miner, we sell our ounces through a trader to the banks. The banks know how many ounces they're going to be getting because, they know the market quite well. Of course, they leverage those in the paper market because they're shorting against that purchase. So Sony buys 20 million ounces. They leverage that up, 300-400 times in the paper market. And it's in their best interest to not allow that spot price to change that dramatically, because all of a sudden, and that whole run in 2011 from $40 or, call it, 35, depends on who you listen to, but $40 to $50, that was all short covering. And the banks were in super stress during that period of time. There's talk about, that's why, Bear Stearns, I think it was, or whomever ultimately went bankrupt because of their big paper derivative position on silver. Whether that's true or not, who knows? But there's lots of information on the internet that you can find, that discusses that topic. There's a big short position in the market, and it's all held by the banks, and it's all because silver is a very commercial market, and it's very thin. And then so these guys and these are young 30-year-old MBAs out of college that have no clue about, the supply and demand fundamentals of the metal, yet they've been shorting silver for the last 30 years. But, they don't know that the above-ground supplies of silver back in the 80s was 5 billion ounces. And back then, there was no electronic uses. The electronic uses just started coming in. Today, the above-ground supplies are about 1 billion ounces, and it's all in ETFs. So all that above ground supply has been eaten away in electronics, and it's no one's recycling cell phones or computers. All that computer waste is just thrown into dumps.
So you got 1 billion ounces above ground, cell phones being thrown away. I mean, how much of that silver is really actually reharvested?
It's a very small amount. These are numbers that we talk about within the industry that they're not exact, but 90% of all silver that's been mined is gone. It's in waste dumps, it's in the ocean, it's gone. you know, 90% of all gold that's been mined is still sitting on the surface mm-hmm. in vaults, you know, in hoards and so on and so forth. So, you know, silver is very much a depleting asset because, you know, in this cell phone, like, you know, my little Apple here, there's about $2 or $3 of silver in this thing. Mm-hmm. And to take it out, it would cost a fortune because Apple is very good at embedding silver into that circuit board. And there's not too many technologies out there that can extract it in an economical way. So no one, you know, recycles computer waste. Yeah. And that's where a lot of our silver goes. And so it just, you know, gets, you know, put in waste dumps, unfortunately. And that's what happens.
Keith, I'm pretty a layman on this. And I'd a friend of mine, actually my business partner owns a gold mine in Alaska. And he walked me through how they built it. And I'm like, insanity. So they take the raw ore in these big bags and they put them on a boat and they ship them to Germany where they're smelted and they're paid. So I'm like, you take it from Alaska to Germany. I mean, this is insane conversation to me. And that the buyers of it know how to buy the bag, which I guess they can figure out how much gold's in there. It seems like insane the way it's done. Can you walk us through how you mine silver and like the steps from we have a mine, do we take a little pick in there and get it out and
we
get a little cube
and
wash
some rocks?
And how does it go from wherever it starts to wherever it ends?
Yeah, so well, every mine is different and every country is different. So it's not a simple answer, but what I can tell you is that it's absolutely almost criminal that we sell silver for $25 an ounce today.
Yep.
Because the blood, sweat, and tears that goes into the production of that metal is horrendous. And it starts from decades ago, whereby as a mining company, you drill a hole and you're relying on geologists that are telling you, okay, this is the right place to drill a hole. And so you believe them and you finance it, you got to raise the money. So you drill the hole, you know, crossing your fingers that you actually hit something, and lo and behold, you hit some silver. And then you have to drill more holes because you can't just, you know, rely on one hole. So you need to drill dozens and dozens and dozens of holes over, you know, a lengthy period of time, you know, 4, 5, 10 years in some cases. So then you have to put out proper disclosure to the regulatory authorities. In order to raise substantial money, you have to, you know, you're going to rely on the governments to permit the process along the way, because, you know, a variety of permits are necessary. You know, depending on the size of the property and the size of the asset or the size of the resource that you've drilled out, it depends on how much money you're going to have to raise, because that is going to be dependent on the size of the mill you're going to build. So you're by 10 years in, You're starting construction, and you're by the time you're in production, you could be, you know, call it 10 to 15 years in, and you're probably, you know, 200 million minimum, and probably even up towards 500 million, or even if it's a larger mine, up towards a billion invested to that point. You still don't have any revenue yet. You're still relying on permits. You're still relying on governments. You're hoping, you're crossing your fingers that the governments don't change, regulations don't change, that the governments are still supportive of what you're doing. You hope to get the communities on side. You hope to get people, you know, employed, because a lot of times you have to build towns, build electrical infrastructure, build water infrastructure, build roads. Because lots of times these mines are, you know, in the middle of nowhere. So now you're 15 years in and you're finally into revenue. So, you know, whatever the number is, $500 million to $1 billion invested, it's going to take you likely 10 years to get your investment back. So at that point, it's all metal price, right? And we all know how metal prices fluctuate. So you have to have a pretty darn good asset and good people in place that are watching their costs in order to, you know, pull out a profit from that operation. So by 20 years in, 20 some odd years in, and every mine's different, of course, as I said earlier, you start to, you know, get a positive cash flow. And hopefully your mine is going to be operating for the next 20 to 30 years after that. And the community is robust and bustling, and you have, you built schools, elementary schools, secondary schools, and you're educating people, and, you know, there's stores opening, you know, maybe a movie theater in town, and, you know, you built a community from zero, from scratch. And I've done it myself a number of times, you know, where we have, you know, 5,000 people living in a town that's all run, or all relying, pardon me, on this one mine that didn't exist 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And now it's a bustling community, and we are the guys that built it from scratch, and we're supplying all the revenue for that community. And it's pretty exciting. That's why I do mining, because I love it. And this builds long-term wealth, right? Because these kids that we're bringing up, that we're putting through school, you know, go on to university and learn other education, and they build wealth among their governments or among their communities. But it's a big job, super capital.
15 years, that much capital intensive, and you convince someone to let you do that?
I've done it all my career.
Isn't that crazy?
How do you know the hole's any good?
You have to keep, you know, you got to rely on professionals around you. I've got 300 geologists and 500 engineers that work for me. So that's their job.
How many times have you drilled a hole and there was nothing there?
Oh, many times. Hundreds of times.
Hundreds of times.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, if not more.
I'm fascinated that you mine in Mexico. What's it like in general with the risk, the foreign risk of being down there?
Well, you know, Mexico, you know, 20 years ago when I put First Majestic together, was easier for sure. You know, September 2023 was our 20th year anniversary. But, you know, I put First Quantum together in 1992. So, you know, I early on in my career, you know, I'm going to Africa and I'm surrounded by, you know, militia you know, you talk about security issues, you know, compare, you know, Africa to Mexico, it's a little bit different issue, but, you know, at least the education in Mexico is slightly higher, and they're, you know, I don't want to get into too much detail, but I learned a lot about risk when I was operating in Mexico, when I was operating in Africa. So when I showed up in Mexico in 2002, it was quite refreshing to me. I think this is great. This is like, wow, this is fantastic. First of all,
they have tacos in Mexico, and I've been to Africa, and I love the safari, but I'd rather eat the Mexican food. I'm just kidding. What did you do in Africa versus Mexico?
We mine copper. Yeah. So I built the first mine in Africa, Southern Africa, in 35 years. So wow. We were the first investment in the copper belt in 35 years.
Where was that at in Africa?
That was in Ndola, Zambia. The copper belt, yeah.
But like, I'm curious about how this is what I'm trying to say is, like, people ask me all the time, like, Todd, how did you raise $500 million? How do you do this? How do you do that? And I said, well, this is how I did it. But the question is really, you went to Zambia. How did you know that there was a copper mine in Zambia? Like you had to make a decision to go to Zambia. You didn't randomly just look at a map and say, okay, Zambia is the place I'm going. You had intel that led you to get there. And I don't need to be specific, but was it just industry knowledge, or someone called you up on the phone and said, hey, I got a great idea, and it resonated? How did you get to Zambia?
It was a phone call. You know, I put together First Quantum back in 92, as I said, and I was looking around for assets. Back then, Venezuela was quite hot. Peru was quite hot. There was a pretty famous discovery in Venezuela back in the early 90s. And so there's a lot of focus from the institutional money around the world on that part of the world. So, you know, we focus our early efforts on South America, and we were going down the path of acquiring an asset in that region of the world. And due to my contacts, my institutional contacts, I received a telephone call from a fellow in London who I respect. And he said, hey, look, you know, this guy just came into my office, Phil Pascal, and who just passed away about a month ago. He just walked into my office with this copper asset in Zambia that you should really look at. It's quite interesting. So I flew over to London and looked at the asset, and it was quite interesting looking, good grades, obviously, and it was already defined. So the resource was defined. We knew how many ounces or how many pounds of copper existed. We knew what the grade was. So enough work was done on the property for us to, you know, make a decision. So we flew down to Zambia and looked at it and fell in love with it. And I decided to buy it. Put Phil Pascal on as chairman of the company at that time. And, you know, that was his, you know, I guess, position he received as part of the acquisition. And then we went and raised the money, and we built the mill. And by the end of, and that was 95. And then by 98, we're in production. And by 2000, we had 9,000 employees.
What happened? What happened with First Quantum?
I left in 2000, I went into semi-retirement until 2002.
Does it still operate down there?
Oh yeah. So First Quantum is $13 billion market cap. It's one of the largest copper companies in the world.
Wow.
Wow. Well, I must be not paying attention. I only trade Freeport for some reason. Oh yeah. I don't know why. Remember that we traded yeah. Oh my God, we traded the hell out of that thing. Sorry, you know, I probably know First Quantum. I'm just not paying attention.
13
billion. Highly successful. I can't take credit for the last, you know, since I left, but nevertheless, it's a very well respected, highly successful copper company.
So Jason, he said we could ask any question. He didn't care. So I'm going to let you ask some questions, and I'm going to come back to what the future of First Majestic is after your questions.
Well, one question is, are you going to consider having any third parties sell First Majestic's bars and rounds from your store, or is it just going to be direct from your website?
The issue is that I don't want to sell silver wholesale.
Yeah.
The whole purpose of us opening our own mint is to capture that premium. We ran into an issue whereby, we're using, I don't want to name mints, we all know the mints that are there in the United States. And, I'm not sure if it was they looked at us as competition, but we would have, hundreds of thousands of ounces of silver sitting on the floor of these mints. And we'd have, orders lined up to produce, 100,000 1 ounce rounds, 1,000 kilo bars, and we have orders in the system. We need these ounces delivered because we've got orders for these ounces, and they would delay and delay and delay, and it would take them 4 to 6 months to turn our ounces around. So our inventories were quite high, sitting on the floors of these third party mints, which is our silver, which we of course have to account for, but nevertheless, we just weren't able to get them out into the marketplace. So we said, screw this, and we're going to do this ourselves. And so I made the decision about a year ago, and we started buying up the equipment, and we got fantastic staff of mint professionals that have worked for many of the other minting companies that we're able to convince to come across. Now we put together a pretty fantastic management team. Now we're 2 weeks in. So after about a year of construction and building the team, we're only going to produce three products to start with. Now we're producing kilo bars, 10-ounce bars, and 5-ounce bars. And we expect to triple our sales in 2024 compared to 2023.
Keith, so I was on the site today, and I noticed a lot of the stuff was sold out. What do you think the supply is going to be again? It's the 1-ounce bar, the 5-ounce bar, and the 10?
Yeah, we're producing 5-ounce bars, 10-ounce bars, and kilo bars.
On kilo bars.
Is that going to be, is that in Elko, Keith? Elko, Nevada?
No, in Las Vegas.
It's in Las Vegas. Well, we're right here.
Yeah.
Wait, hold on a second. The store is?
No, the Mint is.
The Mint's in Vegas.
It is, yes.
And how much do you think you can mint a year there?
You know, we want our entire production to go through the Mint. So we produce 10 million ounces. And don't forget, like I said earlier, that's 3 billion paper ounces I want to take off the market. So if I can get our entire production through the Mint, that's going to really shake up the industry a little bit. These banks expect to see those ounces on their books, right?
Yeah.
And they're expecting to deliver those ounces to commercial buyers like the Sonys and the Teslas and the BMWs of the world. If I take that metal off the market, and what's that going to do to their book, right? And that's the whole strategy. If I can convince Coeur and Hecla and other mining companies to put their silver through our Mint, that's going to take more metal off the market.
Do you think you'll have the capacity and the workers to do that?
You know, that the Mint, as it sits today, has a capacity of about 3.5 million ounces. That's one shift, 4 days a week. In Nevada, for whatever reason, people only work 4 days a week. I'm not sure exactly why that is, but
but I wish that were the case.
They're playing.
I don't think that's the case.
They're playing Keno the other day.
Yeah.
So what we would do is put a second shift on and.
You said it was 2 weeks ago. So is the store selling enough now where you would sell out that way, or is it just too early right now?
The store is still under First Majestic Silver. The first Mint inauguration or launch is in a couple of days, and we'll put out a news release once that happens.
Will you have an actual retail storefront where Jason Bartholomew could walk in?
You know, it's funny you say that, because I was actually talking to my VP the other day, and I said to him, hey, let's find a little store on the strip. And there's just a little postage stamp. It doesn't have to be big.
Yep.
Just something small. So because there's so much traffic, that'd be, you know, great to have a little, you know, kiosk or a little store on the strip. So we may do it.
Well,
we'll have to talk about
that. It's so funny. He says, do you have any idea how long we've been talking about being able to sell your silver? We probably been talking about it for what, a couple of years, right?
For sure.
I guess how long have you been considering going? I mean, as long as I can remember. So maybe I'm wrong in timing. No. Maybe it's because I'm 54. It's a blur.
Keith's the only one.
Have we
that,
not been saying this for like ever? No, like, yes. Maybe he'll let us sell his silver.
Keith's the only one that has, well, to my knowledge, Keith is the only one that had the cojones to do this, in my from what
can
I've
you
seen,
not say balls on a podcast.
Yeah, all right, the balls.
Well, Keith, the reason we say this is because we have a fairly big following, and we wanted to actually, you know, we were actually thinking about, hey, you could buy this through us, and you guys would be here, and you know, that's a whole different conversation, I guess, for something offline.
Well, what we should do is create a stamp with your name on it.
Well, we would like a risk off or a risk on.
A stamp with my name.
A bar
on it.
Or some advertisement or something, because that's the whole thing. We're getting contacted. We just signed a deal with a third party and to produce, you know, ounces for them with their seal on it, their stamp on it. So mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to be approaching hockey teams, baseball teams, football teams, colleges, universities, mm-hmm. You know, these special runs that other mints don't want to do. It's a headache for them.
Indy 500 special.
If you think about, well, yeah, I guess I know someone involved with the Indy 500. Do you know anyone?
Yeah, I know somebody.
I do too. We have an Indy 500 team.
On all podcast coin.
No. We got better names than
better.
That. You don't want to put my name on a coin.
We have an Indy team.
We have an Indy team.
Oh,
okay. We race at the biggest race in the world, the Indy 500. So, but you think you're going to eventually take all your production offline?
That's the goal.
I want to squeeze all these banks.
Wow. That's an interesting idea.
This is amazing.
Right.
Yeah.
But in terms of selling it though, you right now the process is using your bullion store.
Yeah. It's all online. It's all, you know, we have 85,000 shareholders worldwide. So, mm-hmm. So, you know, our shareholders are probably 30 to maybe even as high as 50% of our sales. And we don't advertise. So you know, now that the Mint is going to be up and running, we're going to put a PR budget behind it. You know, we're going to do a little bit of advertising and, you know, try to get those sales round up.
When will you have the 1 ounce rounds?
Probably June, July. That equipment is not on site yet. It's been ordered, but it doesn't arrive until April, May. And it's going to take a while to get it up and running and so on. So,
But you have the bars in production now?
Yeah.
Okay.
The bars are in production.
Yeah.
Can anyone buy silver through you and just leave it stored with you, or do they all have to take delivery?
You know, we've been debating that internally for some time. And, of course, storing, has its own risks around it. And, we're just in the early stages of running the economics on that. We haven't made a decision. But I think, in some cases, it could make sense.
Keith, do you anticipate, this all comes together here. So Jarrett Canyon, do you anticipate that you might reopen Jarrett Canyon if the conditions are favorable and everything comes together, and then you start minting gold as well?
There's not a lot of money in minting gold because it's such high value. People aren't willing to pay the premiums on it. Gotcha. Your cost of stamping a gold coin is the same as stamping a silver coin. But yet, for whatever reason, that percentage or that markup on silver is just much greater. If you get $50 on a gold coin above spot on a percentage basis, that's quite small. But you get $2 or $3 on a silver coin, it doesn't sound like a lot, but on a percentage basis, it makes a big difference. So, we're really focused on silver. I'm not sure if we might do some small runs on gold, but that's not the focus. But regarding Jarrett Canyon, for sure. Like, our expectations are to get that mine back up and running. To be quite frank with you, when we bought that a couple of years ago, we should have shut it down on day one. Mm-hmm. But we didn't want to be that Canadian mining company that, bought this mine in Elko, Nevada, third largest city in Nevada, that laid off 500 workers on day one. We just didn't want that press. So we figured, okay, let's keep it open. We know the flaws. We know the issues. Let's make the investment. Let's keep everyone employed, and let's try to get this done. And it just turned out that it was just too costly. And we were burning way too much cash, and we underestimated the investment, unfortunately, and we had to shut it down. And so we're going to reset, start from scratch, and which we're doing right now, and make the investment over the next 24 months, and then get it back, hopefully, up and running in 2026.
Yeah, that's one of only three in the state, correct me if I'm wrong, that has the roaster, which is highly valuable. Yeah. And then you bought that from Eric Sprott, right? And he's a large shareholder of First Majestic. So,
that's right.
Eric is the largest shareholder of First Majestic.
No, but he's.
What? Yeah.
Used. I mean, he's got the PSLV ETF.
Right.
PSLV is, in my opinion, the most, if you're going to get exposure to silver through an ETF, that would be the one to do it. They actually take delivery of silver.
Yeah, they actually own the silver.
Yeah. So unlike SLV, which is probably a JP Morgan Chase product, or.
Well, they just own paper. They don't own physical metal.
Yeah.
What do you make of the Costco?
It's pretty fascinating.
I'm beyond fascinated.
There's massive demand, which tells me that, Keith has something here for sure. And a retail store would be really cool. You could have how open pit mines are done, how everything, you could have the history of it. It's Elko, Nevada. You could talk about Jarrett Canyon, which was producing since 1981, like 1972 discovery. Like, I went to Virginia City, which is the old Comstock, and Keith knows this. I went down into a mining shaft, like, I don't even know how far down. And they're showing me how the miners used to do this stuff in the dark, and how they would not hit their arm, chop their hands off, like picks and axes. It's just like crazy. He said it's just like unbelievable that they're selling silver the way it's harvested and the production and how hard it is for $25 an ounce in fiat, which that's another topic, how it's priced in fiat. I don't like that.
Keith, if you got into Costco with your silver and they said, we want to sell $100 million worth, would that be possible or not?
Well, our total revenues last year were 600 some odd million. So it would be a bit of a challenge.
But it would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Yeah. It would be fun to try. Logistically, I'm not sure how we'd pull it off, but
And when you book your total revenues, is that like just the actual ending sell price for what you sell your silver or your gold at? Is there any other revenue from it other that's not mining related?
Well, the mint, of course, would be included in our total revenues. No, it's just the sale of metal, silver and gold would be our total revenue line. And it's reported, you know, in our financial statements, and the number is around $600 million.
So when you see people, and I apologize because this is an education for me. We wanted to talk to you forever, but I'm just not as smart about metals as I am, I guess, with stocks. But and I don't know if I'm smart there after 34 years. I still think I'm learning stuff every day there. Is the Monexes of the world that sell, I guess, precious metals, silver directly, are they going to get it from someone like you and reselling it? Or is there just a big enough spot market where they're lining it up and reselling it to someone else? Like, I'm perplexed as to how there isn't enough silver to sell, yet the price is, it doesn't make any sense to me. I know it doesn't, you said it doesn't make sense to you either, but like you're selling $600 million worth of metal a year, right? So who's buying it besides your shareholders? Who's buying it?
Well, it's all commercials. So without the mint, we have a trader in New York who we phone up and or email, and I say sell 100,000 ounces at $25 an ounce, and he sends an email back, sold. So that 100,000 ounces, they cut a check to us within a couple of days, you know, after that sale. They, you know, that metal goes through the refinery and it gets spit out in 999, you know, 1,000 mm-hmm. ounce commercial bars. Cool. And that buyer or the trader tells the refinery where to send that metal. So it'll go to ABC Electronics Company in California, or it'll go to a window manufacturer somewhere. It'll go wherever. It'll go to a freezer manufacturer, you know, whatever. And so we don't actually see that part of the business because the traders take care of all of that. So they send it wherever it goes. It all goes commercial.
And you have to deliver physical delivery. They're 1,000 ounce Comex commercial bars,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And you're told where to deliver it, and you deliver it to the electronics company. You got paid, and that's it, right? And sure. and I presume that's a different margin than you just selling. Can you sell for spot, or do you have to kind of edge that back a little bit for the trader, or what happens?
No, the trader deals with that. So they get paid from the buyer a commission for that trade. We sell it at spot. So gotcha. If silver's trading at $25 right this moment, we get paid exactly $25.
So then because they're not minted. Mm-hmm. Like the ones he's selling that have to go through the mint, that adds a cost to them, right?
Yeah.
That's our cost.
Yep.
Well, that's our cost. So the Dory bars from the mine get shipped to the refinery in our case, Asahi in Salt Lake City, because that's the primary refinery that we use. And they charge us, you know, it's not very much. It's like 25 cents an ounce. So our Dory bars are 95% to 97% silver, and they refine it down to 999 or 499s, mm-hmm. and that's what they sell.
Got it.
Right. So for us to then resell them, so it's very interesting. It sounds like to me, and there's of course lifting costs, which I'm not going to get into, but the cost of you getting that silver out of the ground is the difference between spot and your margin. Is how you make your money. Got it.
That's right. Yeah. And our costs right now are about, you know, $15-16 an ounce. So, you know, we're selling at 25. So it's, you know, we're making okay money. It's not huge, but it's not bad.
So you've been at First Majestic for, it sounds like, 22 years. You're doing $600 million in sales. You have this initiative for the bullion store. You might open up the one on the Strip in Vegas. You're going to try to take all that commercial paper out of the market and sell through your mint. You got 85,000 shareholders worldwide. How old are you now?
63.
You're sick. Well, you look better than me. Look great. Wow, you look great. I thought you were my age. Jesus Christ. What are your plans for the future?
Keep building. You know, we you know, our goal is to become the largest silver company in the world. So,
so a small goal, a small goal. I got you.
You know, it's you got to have goals, right? It's not easy. You know, the problem is with silver, it's such a rare mineral. People don't understand this. You know, Jason brought up earlier in the conversation that, you know, we're mining 7 to 1. So for every 1 ounce of gold we mine worldwide, we only mine 7 ounces of silver, you know, and that, and we're trading at 85 to 1, you know, which is like bananas. You know, explain that one to me. So that tells you, that silver is a lot rarer than the market thinks it is. And, I can tell you that, you know, we scour the planet looking for silver mines, good silver mines. We could load our portfolio up with gold mines tomorrow if we wanted to. If we wanted to become a gold company and forget about silver, that would be like a matter of just a couple of months of deals. But silver, it's shockingly how rare it is. We are looking to build, through acquisition, but it's tough. It's really tough.
I want to talk about Nevada. It's just, you know, the silver state. It was originally big time silver. Is there opportunity still in Nevada to like go find silver mines, or does that not exist anymore?
It is. You had Howard Hughes. You had Charles Schwab as very early investors in Nevada. You know, in the Silver Belt. You know, Tonopah. You know, is a famous area in Nevada. You know, which produced a ton of silver. You know, there's a couple of junior companies active there, which First Majestic is shareholders of. We own positions of a couple of juniors that are active in that area. We've done site visits and we continually watch this silver space, you know, looking for potential acquisitions. But, you know, our shareholders would not be too pleased with me, you know, if we just go buy an exploration project. You know, it doesn't do us any good. You know, for us to move the needle, you know, we need to buy something that's either in production or permitted, ready for construction. You know, we can't wait 10 years for, you know, permits and, you know, all that stuff that needs to happen. So we let the juniors, you know, fight that battle and let them get to a point where it makes sense for us. And, you know, we've got tolls in a number of juniors and, you know, we're actively looking at Arizona, Nevada, you know, Mexico, of course. You know, we know Mexico very well, but even outside of the United States and Mexico and Canada, Europe, Australia, we're pretty active.
Who owns First Majestic? I mean, what are your holdings as a public company relative to institutional holdings? What's the demographic look like of your shareholder base?
Well, it's all public, but I own over 4 million shares. My share position has never gone backwards except when I got divorced. My ex-wife took half my position, unfortunately. but since then, it's
I don't know anyone that's ever had that problem, Keith. You're the only one that's ever had that issue.
Yeah, I know. Anyways, it's still bittersweet, but nevertheless. But ever since then, my position has always gone up over the years. And, we have, I guess the biggest would be Van Eck. You know, they own 20 million shares or some crazy amount. And then a bunch of ETFs. We're about, you know, probably 30-40% institutionally held. And the rest would be retail. We have a very large retail shareholder base. Predominantly United States. We've got a huge retail shareholding in the United States. We're broadly followed in the mining sector, in the silver space. Germany, Switzerland, Austria, UK. We've got very large shareholders over there as well.
You talked about you know, what you presently have, and like it just from a layman's perspective, we're talking to a layman like me. How many years of production do you have left with your current stuff you have? If you didn't make any new acquisitions, and you mine this all in as far as you could into the ground, how much production do you have left?
You know, it's always, you know, a tough question, because these are underground mines. And these are veins that you never know when they end. You know, they could end tomorrow, or they can go on for many, many years in the future. An open pit mine is quite defined. You can drill it out, you know exactly what's there, and you can actually put a life of mine around it, and it's pretty certain. But underground mines are not the same. And economically, it never makes sense to drill, because you blow your brains out drilling it out, because these veins go on for kilometers and kilometers and kilometers, and it just doesn't make sense. So you try to keep the life of mine between 3 to 5 years. As a mining company, that's kind of a magic number. That way you can have, you know, you can have long-term plans and so on and so forth. But, you know, our biggest mine, San Dimas, has been in production for 300 years. I don't know when it's going to end. No time that we can measure. Santa Elena, on paper, it has a 7-year mine life, but it's going to be, you know, much longer than that. Lincoln Tata, our small mine, it's always been plagued by a very small or short mine life, 2 to 3 years, because that's the nature of that particular type of ore body. So it would cost way too much money to expand that. So we just keep it at 2-3 years. And we hope it'll just keep, you know, we've owned that mine since 2005, and the mine life has always been 2 to 3 years.
Those, you have a lot of gold coming out of those too. It looks
San
like.
San Dimas and San Felina?
Yeah. Well, 74,000 ounces.
Yeah. San Dimas is 50-50 silver gold, and San Felina is 60-40 gold silver.
Yeah. Those are nice. They're all underground too, which avoids any kind of things that are going on with the regime change down there. A lot of people don't realize that.
Well, yeah. I was actually going to ask that question about the Mexico potential ban of open pit mining. Is that going to happen? Is that it? What's the status there?
Well, it's likely not going to happen, but it's a lot of politicking. AMLO's he's, I hate to say anti-investment, but I guess, you know, it's, to be kind to him, I guess that's the best way of putting it. You know, he doesn't like foreign investment, period.
Yeah.
As I said earlier in the interview, you know, 20 years ago when I put the company together, you know, Mexico was a little bit of a different country. You know, permitting back then was, you know, 4 to 6 months to permit a mine. And today, you know, it'll take you a couple of years to permit the same situation. So it's become a lot more difficult. And we're hoping that the elections that are coming up on June 2nd are going to change things. Rumors are we more or less know who the incoming guard is, or the new president is going to be. And, you know, she seems reasonable. We hope, we're crossing our fingers. But look, we're in Mexico. That's the bottom line.
Like, yep.
You can't pick up a mine and move it to another country. So we have 4,000 employees in Mexico. We're a big player in Mexico. We're the third largest silver producer in the entire country. We're active in 8 states. We're pretty well known.
But so when I asked about the future of First Majestic, you being 63, would you ever be a seller, or is that not something that's on your radar in the future, meaning selling all of First Majestic?
Well, you know, First Quantum, you know, going back to then, I'd use that as an example. If I'm on the road talking about the company, I'm on stage, you know, and there's, you know, 500 people in the room listening to me do a presentation, I can't exactly be on the offer selling stock. You know, that to me is immoral. Yeah. Unless somehow, you know, you're Elon Musk and you say, look, I want to, you know, my stock is at some kind of crazy number, and is it okay if I sell a little bit? And the shareholders say, okay, go ahead and do it. Okay, maybe there's an exception there, but for the, you know, whether I I can't imagine that happening, but maybe.
No,
maybe.
I think I didn't make that clear. I mean, like, would you be a seller of all of First Majestic, meaning would the company be sold? Because if you look at a production situation, right, and people want to have production, the stock seems very inexpensive. Would there not be an opportunity for someone just to buy all of the production and own the whole company? Or is that not something that you see in the cards down the road? And I'm, by the way, we're totally speculating. I'm just getting your idea of what the next 10 years looks like.
Yeah, no, look, there's two things that are going to happen, in my opinion. Well, three things. Nothing happens, which would be one of the three. And we continue to grow our business and we become too big to buy. We're almost there now. There's only a couple players out there that are bigger than us in the silver space. So the other two things that could potentially happen is a big conglomerate, like, you know, one of the big copper players, like a BHP or, you know, one of the huge mining.
Freeport.
Yeah, Freeport. You know, they decide, hey, we want to get into silver because, you know, the silver story is so fantastic and we want exposure. Mm-hmm. So they want to buy a silver company and our name gets put on their table. So that could happen. The other thing that could happen is the technology companies. And this is kind of like, you know, my thesis. And I've said this before, but, you know, if you listen, you know, you watch the movie iRobot, for example, you know, you've got a conglomerate like an Apple, mm-hmm. you know, who owns basically the entire supply chain. And, you know, like, you know, these big conglomerates, the technology conglomerates, you know, they're at mercy of their supply chain. And they, you know, they don't influence their commodity prices that they're, you know, having to be exposed to. So, you know, you see Elon, you know, looking at nickel and lithium, you know, whether that, you know, gets, you know, whether the rest of the industry looks at that as a goal, and then they start looking at, hey, look, we want to own the entire mining sector. You look at, my VP Corp Dev showed me yesterday a slide, NVIDIA is 5 times the market cap of the entire mining sector, all metals combined, copper, coal, nickel, every single metal combined, NVIDIA is 5 times the market cap. Can you imagine?
Yes, I can, actually. I'm in the equity market, and I own a data center in Michigan in like my company and two in Montana. And those data centers are selling for, I don't know, a few billion dollars. And I own a 300 megawatt data center that's presently running 300 mega or 30 megawatts. And I look at the valuation of our whole company, which is, I think, what our public market float is 15 million. Mm-hmm. It's insanity. And I actually think what you're selling silver for is insanity. I mean, I think you're literally giving it away. It's kind of crazy. And I don't mean that in a negative way, like you're doing it. I mean, the market is the market, but like, it's insane how cheap it is. And I think it's a fascinating story that you're going to sell directly to people. You're almost democratizing the ability for people to get silver, to own your company and to buy it from you. I think it's just a great model. Jason's really turned me on to what you're doing and trying to get done. And I look forward to meeting you. I mean, it's really a fascinating model. We actually were kind of hoping we could help you sell it, but it sounds like to me, your shareholder base is going to do that for you. I'll be one of them because I noticed that I get a 50-cent discount when I'm a shareholder.
Yeah.
You got to just prove that you have 100 shares or so, right?
Yep. That's it.
You know, for
friends and relatives, you get 50 cents. So you can get a dollar off.
Well, thank you so much. Right. What I'm perplexed about though, Jason, is that, you know, you and I have been together many years in terms of doing business and doing a podcast. This was your number one guest.
Yes.
Okay. So ask a question that's hard for him, because this was your number one request of all the people you've ever wanted on the podcast. And you and I have done like almost 300 shows together. This is the guy. He's
the guy
right in front of you. What's on your mind? He's going to have a beer with you possibly. What is it you want to ask him?
Well, I mean, we've covered a lot, but I wanted to get into like the macroeconomic geopolitical stuff, Keith. And by the way, he's the one that actually donned the name Triple Digit Silver. So
that's right.
I really believe that Triple Digit Silver is in the near future, just my opinion. Mm-hmm. But Keith, you noticed today, just, you know, in a granular look at the spot price of silver and gold today, it kind of pulled back a little bit. I don't think people understand with the Fed funds rates, how they can affect the precious metals market. And I try to tell people, well, if the Fed funds rates don't get cut, then it's not really bullish for precious metals. So you're seeing the Fed funds rate at like 5.5%. Jerome Powell comes out and says, you know, he's doesn't anticipate cutting rates this year. Then he says he might cut rates. And then the CPI numbers come in hot. The PPI numbers come in hot. Retail sales are terrible. Credit revolving credit card debt is over $1 trillion. Well, here we have the infamous
that's fine.
U.S. debt clock. There you go. The national debt, $34.5 trillion. Over here,
by the way, I think that's $4 trillion higher than when you and I started.
Yes.
Four trillion is accumulated.
And then all the fiat dollars have 40% of them has been printed into existence over the last 3 or 4 years. Here's another number. If you see my cursor here, revenue to GDP ratio. I'm sorry, total debt to GDP ratio, 136%. That number is massive. Inverted yield curve for years and years. I mean, Keith, what do you think overall about the future of the world and specifically like North America as it relates to, you know, cost of living, you know, generations being usually each generation is improving their life and their wellness, you know, one after the other. And now it seems like it might not be the case. I'd like to get your opinion on all that.
It's a mouthful.
Well, yeah, you brought up several points there. I should have written them down if you're speaking of them. But, you know, you're talking about headlines. You know, markets are driven by headlines. And that's it. You know, it's very simple. The money will go where there's money to be made. So, you know, what Powell does, what the Fed does, you know, sure, it's got headline. It'll change the market on a short-term basis due to headlines because a bunch of hedge funds decides to trade against the news. But, you know, it doesn't matter because gold is being bought up by central banks around the world. And that's what's driving price. We've never seen the central banks around the world buy gold as they're doing today. This is historic. Anything that's getting produced, they're buying. Simple as that. And that's dragging silver along. You know, supply demand fundamentals of silver have not showed up in a headline yet. It will. You know, gold's starting to be talked about, but still, you know, you go on to CNBC or CNN, not that I watch those networks, but, you know, do they ever talk about gold? You know, this, you know, gold has, you know, been reaching new highs, you know, fairly consistently for the last, you know, couple of weeks. And I don't see it really being mentioned anywhere. The supply and demand fundamentals of silver, don't get mentioned anywhere. Is it the press or the banks don't want it to be mentioned because they're paranoid that, if these headlines do actually get published, that all of a sudden further investment's going to come into this sector and even cause them more grief? Because I can tell you, I'm sure that the financial system is getting as stressed as a result of the move in metal prices over the last few weeks. I can almost guarantee that. So it's not in their best interest to see what's happening out there. So I think they're trying to purposely suppress this whole headline discussion. You know, they want us to focus on NVIDIA and Apple and Microsoft and, you know, mm-hmm. the top seven or whatever they call them. And, you know, the retail investor, I've heard, you know, through what I read that there's, you know, investors coming into this market that are first time investors that are starting to buy these big high tech companies, which is, you know, pretty shocking. You look at 2000, and I remember it very clearly because I just left First Quantum in 2000, and I see the Nasdaq hitting 5,000 in March of 2000. Basically, I don't know, like a 200 or 300% run over the previous 2-3 years.
Nasdaq 100 it was crazy. It was parabolic.
It was nuts. What was happening, right? Y2K, oh geez, remember Y2K? Mm-hmm.
I remember Y2K. I remember me buying ePay on a Friday at $9, and the following Friday being $99. One of the most insane situations ever. I was short Amazon. It went up $100 in a single day. By the way, buying Amazon then was still a winner.
Yeah.
Keith, you're onto something because if you recall the Nifty 50 in the 70s, and I know you and I were a lot younger then. But the Nifty 50 dominated the world until they cracked. And mm-hmm. when you owned Coca-Cola in 73, it didn't get back to parity till 83.
Wow.
And you got now seven stocks basically sucking the oxygen out of the room. It's a scary proposition.
Well, and how long did it take for the NASDAQ to get back to 5,000?
10 years, 15, I think, right?
Yeah, 15 years. 2015 it hit. So
right.
13 years or whatever it was.
Right. Took a long time for it to get back. It was a hit. It was a brutal hit.
Yeah. And then what happened in the mining sector during that period of time, right? So and that's why I talk about money flows, mm-hmm. headlines. Mm-hmm. So it's all to do with money flows, something, you know, that people tend to ignore. But that all that money left the high-tech sector and it had to find a home. So it went into real estate, it went into mining stocks, went into gold, silver. You know, gold was $250 an ounce in 2002, silver was $5. You know, silver went up 10 times over the next 10 years. Silver or gold went up 8 times in the next 10 years. And, you know, the mining sector was just lit up and we had one of the, well, probably the biggest bull market in my career, you know, over that period of time. And now we've gone into a 10-year bear market. And now we're just coming out of it. And who knows when this major market's going to crash, but I think it will. And it's going to, unfortunately, suck a lot of young people into it. I've got young kids and, you know, and you know, my kids say, oh, should I be buying this stock? Should I be buying that stock? And I say, you know, should I buy Bitcoin? And I say, no, just don't chase this stuff. Just, you know, I give them some mining names and they own a couple, they own First Majestic and they own, you know, some other, you know, mining stocks I like. And I try to keep them away from, you know, those big flyers because I'm paranoid that, you know, there is going to be this huge crash, you know, like we saw in 2000. That's going to last for the next couple of years. I think we're going to go into another 10-year run. And, you know, gold at, you know, 2000 over the next 10 years, if you see the same move, does that mean 8 times gold from current levels? It seems like a big number to me, but, you know, is that possible? You know, I am a triple digit silver guy. I do think that silver is going to go north of $100 and, you know, gold at 3,000, 5,000, silver at, you know, 100, 150 an ounce. I think those are reasonable numbers.
Yeah. So if you had 100 million extra laying around, you'd put it in silver?
I'd buy First Majestic for one.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would definitely buy more First Majestic.
That would get the ratios back historical too, Keith. If, you know, that 30 to 50 to one sweet spot. That's very doable.
So he'd be long First Domestic for the move in the miners with
the leverage
silver.
Is way better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you go back 20 years.
You know, that was what I was asking you earlier, Keith. Come on. It took a while to get to that answer. That's exactly what I'm saying. It's $5. The leverage has got to be huge.
Yeah. No, it's between 200 to 300%. It, you know, it depends. You
okay.
You
so
over the last 20 years. And it's
like, let me give you my thesis on you. Okay. This is my thesis. So I was long MicroStrategies for being Bitcoin because I thought, okay, I got a software company paying a dividend, which is not really paying a dividend, but you get my point is I got an operating company I own and they're long Bitcoin, right? So Bitcoin doesn't have a yield. So I got this $500 million software company and I'm long Bitcoin. So Bitcoin makes a move, right? So if you get long First Majestic, you got an engine of mining producing silver.
Yep.
And if silver makes a parabolic move, you got the move in silver. And you got the fact that he's the one of the few miners out there. You get a lot of leverage, right?
Yeah.
So First Majestic could make a run here from, say, $5 to 20, and you could be up, what, 4X your money?
Yep.
Yeah, that's 4X your money.
Even if silver only
went
2X.
Even if silver went up 2X.
Yeah.
Yeah. Am I right? Is that the logic, or am I flawed?
Yeah. For you know, historically, for every dollar move, and it works negatively as well, so don't get me wrong. It's not always positive. But you know, for every dollar,
we owned some at 18 when it went down, so we know.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, for every dollar move, our stock would move $2 to $3 mm-hmm. thereabouts.
There you go. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, Keith, I would be able to talk to you forever, but I have a meeting in downtown Vegas I got to go to, and I'm a little bummed because this took forever to get done. And
I know.
And I'm sure you don't want to sit here on the for us. But I ask you two things. Hopefully, we can see on the 24th. But would you be willing to come back again in a couple months?
Sure. Absolutely. Hopefully we'll have $30 silver prices by then.
It would be great. We can't do it, but it would be great if we had them in the studio.
Yeah, it would be great.
Well, and you'll have one of our new kilo bars in hand.
That's awesome. We appreciate you. Keith, really, First Majestic CEO and founder, been doing this for 22 years with First Majestic, and before that with
First Quantum,
and obviously bullish on silver. We're super happy to have you here, and we will be directing. Obviously, this is a recorded episode. It is the what is today? The 14th of March.
Yep.
We'll make sure that you guys know about his store and how to become a shareholder and how to buy silver. Jason, you got so much of this stuff. You got silver everywhere, right?
Yeah, oh yeah. My wife said I can never sell my silver.
There you go.
We have possession of it.
Yeah, he has physical possession of it. Yeah. We're big fans, Keith. We appreciate you being on the show, and good luck in the future. And we'll keep monitoring you, and we'll buy some shares, and hopefully we'll be seeing triple digit silver.
Well, it's a great opportunity, Todd, and then Jason. I've watched your stuff historically. It's nice to be on your podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Keith. Take care.
There's a reason for it.
So I did get that right.